This is a production of Cornell University.
I now call the meeting to order at 4:36 p.m. Tuesday, March 26th. First order of business, we need to approve the minutes from Tuesday, February 26th, because we did not have quorum at the last meeting. Any amendments to the minutes on February 26th? I hear none. Any oppositions to passing the minutes? I hear no objections. We pass the minutes for February 26th, 2013. Next, we have the minutes from Tuesday, March 12th. Any amendments to the minutes on Tuesday, March 12th? I hear none. The minutes has been passed for Tuesday, March 12th. Next, we have reports from the assemblies from the executive board. Liz?
It may come as no surprise that we didn't have a meeting last week. Considering we were on spring break, but we tried to brainstorm where certain resolutions are behind the scenes, and also like the surveillance resolution, and also ideas for the discussion today with President Gordon.
Thank you, Liz. Next on the student assembly.
Hi, Adam's not here. He's on his way back from Passover. The last assembly meeting was before spring break, and what the big debate there was whether or not we should change our charter, change our bylaws, and implement a student-run Supreme Court. I don't know what that means. I personally don't support it. We tabled it indefinitely 2 meetings ago, and then it magically came before us again. We'll see where it goes, but just if you have any questions about it, I don't support it, but I know it very well. So.
Can you refresh our memory a bit on what the Supreme Court would?
Well, it would be the only court, so therefore it is the lowest and the highest court. I don't know why we have to call it the Supreme Court, but the way it's written is that the students will have the ability to. Do isn't the right word, but the same action as doing student to student organization, and also appeal to them to reverse student assembly decisions. So the idea is to have another check for the student assembly. I think it's just another ridiculous layer of bureaucracy. Again, I am completely biased in this. But they're talking about giving this body the right to sign students, put them on academic hold, so that means they can't work, they can't hold a campus job at this Supreme Court body, puts them on hold, their status on hold, and also the right to subpoena other students to go come before this body. Alan, do you have any other input for it?
No. I just want to know if the justices will have lifetime of them.
No, that's a great question. I don't think so.
Rest calls.
Yeah.
Gonna add that Supreme Court goes ahead and right to charge people some kind of fee.
Oh, it said that. Yep, they can find them. I think up to $25. That's what the wording is.
Oh my.
From how I understood it is that the reason we're doing this is because other universities do it. I don't like that mentality. I don't think we need it, and I don't think that's what. But,
all right,
that's from the student assembly.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Peter. Ellis?
Where does the authority for this come from?
Oh, we have to change our bylaws. Change our charter.
Well, changing your bylaws and charter doesn't mean that you can keep students from working or getting grades or doing anything like that or imposing fines.
So you can imagine why I don't support it.
But how does another constitution or university bylaws or trustees do that?
And how does it dovetail with the director of the charity?
It would be strictly under like student organization. So if you felt that a student organization went against the bylaws that the student assembly passed for them, they could sue, I hate this word sue, but you know what I'm saying, sue that student organization through the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court could issue a decision.
And you pay up $25.
Exactly. And the $25 they said would go into like the federal fund where the student activity fee goes. I mean, that's fine with me, but anyway, that's from the student assembly. Joy, back to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Next, we have Mitch Pay for the GPSA. I know you had a big week today, this week.
I did. So we had a meeting last night. We didn't talk about judicial things. We passed our graduate professional community initiative, which is our strategic plan. What I've been talking to you guys about all year long. It's really exciting. It's a big document. It covers 8 different topic areas, from career resources, international students, transportation, and just a wider range of things. And I think moving forward, I would like to get the chance to present it both at the university assembly and that at each of the constituent assemblies. I think there are a lot of things in it that graduate and special students feel that we can create some partnerships on. There are certain things on particularly transportation and housing that I think the graduate and special students could develop some partnerships with on, whatever words I'm supposed to be using, with the employee assembly. Similarly, I think there's a bunch of initiatives that the GPSA can work with the student assembly on, so I hope you get the chance to present it at each of the different assemblies. We're still working on the final document, so I'll get it out to Joy and to the different chairs of the assemblies here soon, and it's exciting. We also, I know this is a topic that is kind of interest in some student assembly leaders. We had a resolution on divestment that was brought forward at our March 4th meeting, and we indefinitely postponed it last night. So the GPSA is not going to take a stance on divestment. I think that's not to say that we don't support the principles of it, that we don't support the actions that we did in the resolution. And we have elections coming up both on April 8th for voting members, and we have elections on April 22nd at our last meeting of the year for the executive team.
Thank you, Mitch. Next, we have the employee assembly. Bridget?
Let's see. We had our last open forum on the 30 results, and I'm talking with Mary Chris. We're going to be moving forward with our recommendations very shortly and get them up to date. It's been a long process, but we felt that we did a good job reaching out to everybody and collecting all of the feedback on the recommendations would be very helpful to move forward. We are working on a couple of resolutions we haven't quite settled on yet. And we also did some brainstorming on perhaps a new award that may be given out to HR and management from the employee to recognize the work that they're doing. And I didn't know if Greg had anything else to add, maybe in particular with the employee care fund.
Yeah, we're still, I don't know if we mentioned this last meeting, but we're still pushing forward, looking to endow the employee care fund, which is the fund that's available to faculty and staff at the university who come under some sort of hardship and they apply the criteria. Right now, it's just sort of bleeding money that we really don't have, and there's constantly an influx of funds from HR. So there's a few of us on the board that are pretty passionate about trying to create an endowment that would kick out a reasonable amount for that. So we're exploring that right now with Mary and Charlie. And trying to figure out what's the best avenue to get through. So more to come on that, but we're hoping that we can keep the ball moving forward.
Thank you, Bridget. Thank you, Greg. Lastly, we have the Faculty Senate.
Paul?
You want to do it, Joe, or should I do it?
Oh, I didn't see you there.
No.
Steve Burns.
I'll do it. Yep. Well, there's a meeting on March 13th, and on the agenda were a number of committee reports, and then the two main items, which were a presentation by Ted Dobbs, Chief Information Technology Officer, 30 minutes, and he had a lot of statistics on the IT, and then also ended up with a chart that looks like this. It's 50-50, and that's moving from 90-10. What he calls differentiators are academic technologies, analytics, research computing, mobility. These are special kind of projects that would set Cornell apart from being just a service kind of a thing. Secondly, Provost Kent Fox and Eve Tardos gave a report on MOOCs, the MOOCs committee. MOOCs is going ahead, and I don't know if there are any particular details on how it's going ahead, but it's going to go ahead.
They're offering, I only know because there's a communications professor, they're offering one course next year with Jeff Hancock and a few others.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a course that's sponsored by Google, and that is the current university course for sixth grade books.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have a kind of study support from Google.
I think they're looking pretty good.
And the report that the provost mentioned is saying that there will be a committee formed to select what MOOCs will be supported by Cornell, and that we will be joining one of the consortium, either probably Coursera or edX. And there was some dispute whether or not the faculty was appropriately consulted in this matter.
Thank you, Bob and Dean Burns. Peter? Oh, sorry. I thought you were raising your hand.
About the faculty.
There was some effect that the whole issue of MOOCs should be worked. Really in front of the town. And at the time, we wanted to get others, my colleagues, really felt that we had done an adequate job. The provost came to the Senate saying he was going to form this committee in September. I co-chaired the formation of the committee. I was on the committee along with five other faculty. When the report came out, he came to the DFC, and said, "What should I do with this report? You should see it." And the DFC decided that our committee on education policy should see it, our committee on academic programs and policy should see it, and in fact, the advisory board on information technology should see it. All three of those saw it, and they came back saying they were approved of the report. The first faculty forum that we had was on MOOCs. That was on September 27th. I think the faculty was being notified about it. But there were others who said, wait, I mean, one person stood up in the meeting and said, I don't know what a MOOC is. Why haven't I been told about this? So you can see how they relate them.
Why don't
we do something properly?
I went to that first forum, which I thought was good, that everybody had a chance to run with.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. Next we have reports from the committees. Code and Judicial Committee, Greg.
So we're going to touch on a resolution here in business of the day. Some of the other open items that we have, we're currently in discussion about the freedom of speech, freedom of expression, sort of discussion that's going around. I say it sort of very broadly and loosely because there's been nothing formally proposed to the CJC by a UA member yet. There's some ideas floating out there, so hopefully we can try to wrangle those in. We've got a minor code change, relatively minor, that we've been discussing now for the last two meetings. which probably by the next QA meeting we'll see something more formal on that in form of a resolution. We are talking about hearing and review board recruitment, I'm proposing a change to that, and the change would be that we move away from the interview process and have a more robust online application process, which then is reviewed just based on the nature of all of our work-life balance and those sorts of things, which don't exist for some, really anybody, trying to make it as efficient and sort of level the playing field so that different interviewers don't ask different questions, get different responses, gauge things differently. We want to put a standard form out there, and we would use the Office of Assembly's new system that's not really new, but sort of new to us, and for committee appointments, and go through there and provide folks access and the ability to read and comment and try to have a more efficient process. So I'm going to, after this meeting, email the CJC and have sort of an online discussion about that, and hopefully have closure to that by the end of the week. So that we can move forward there, because I think it's a minor change. And then one of the things we'll also talk about is, do we need to put something in the code or somewhere that for to live that talks about how the hearing and review board is being recruited and what that process looks like, so that it's not sort of make it up as we go along each year and put some solid timelines, deadlines, things like that in place. Because we recruit anywhere from 9 to 12 folks each year for that board. So then there's plenty of other code things that I know both the JCC and the JA's office would like to see some clarification, minor things, major things. So as we get time and the opportunity to do so, we'll bring those to the group.
All right. Thank you, Greg. Next, we have the Campus Welfare Committee. The Welfare Committee haven't met, but I am going to stick a short update on Resolution 6 in here. Resolution 6 about security, surveillance, cameras, I'm messing it up, has been postponed, unfortunately, for another meeting. Cassie's owner and I feel like there's still some things that need to be tweaked, but we are going to work very hard on it in the next 2 weeks and hopefully have it by the next meeting. Kathy, do you have anything to say about that?
No, I think the idea is to go forward an idea and have a good discussion around looking at our issues and try to capture some of our subjects and what we are today.
All right.
I don't want to bring something forward. Where we stand right now is the language. We're trying to not be too specific about it so that we can.
So we're very, very close. So please look forward to that. Lastly, we have the Campus Infrastructure Committee. Bridget? All right. Nice and short. Let's see. We are expecting the president in about 5 minutes. Do we want to carry on with discussion with Resolution 5 or... Greg is saying yes. So we have on the table Resolution 5, Resolution 2, Modify Campus Code and Disclose Misconduct of University Registered Organizations. Greg, can you head up the discussion on this?
Yeah, so my apologies for missing the last 2 meetings. I was traveling for business purposes, but I think that this is a good change, and I feel that we spent a fair bit of time at the CJC level and talking about different sorts of sides to this. What this essentially does is it attempts to sort of level the playing field for university registered organizations. Greek letter organizations currently, which fall under the Office of Attorney and Historic Affairs and Independent Living, when they are found to violate certain code or have some questionable practices, things like that, that are brought to attention. Part of their sanction could be being posted on hazing.cornell.edu if it does involve a hazing allegation or incident that they're found to be So what this allows is a change of the code to allow the university, Dean of Students Office, student activities to notify the community of incidents of misconduct with registered organizations, or any registered organization that falls under the governance of the code can be reported. I know they're working right now on developing a more robust sort of website or method to communicate these sorts of infractions, but that's sort of the spirit in which it was.
Alright. I guess now the floor is open for discussion on Resolution 5.
Found to be in violation of the code.
Alex and then Mitch.
So I have a few questions. The first is, I've heard that using their Cornell that you use is already taken, it's not all regulations, although when you look at it, it's all three regulations except right from two athletic teams. Is there like a policy against this being shared with the federal organizations? Or like why, I guess how is this changing that aspect? And then the second is calculated. Which is, it seems like what this is doing in the code is like freeing anyone involved in that process I'm talking about, because it's like all who are involved, complaint, investigation, hearing, appeal. And I was wondering if you thought about maybe having a specific, instead of having anyone is free to talk about it with this organization, having a specific, and it should be reported by this person, versus a kind of free-for-all, which seems like how it would be written. So, I need to do that.
I don't think that it's a free-for-all, and I would ask other members of the CJC if they have an opinion on this or thought. Your first question, does TSA at Cornell Remedy U exclude organizations?
So right now, when a student organization goes through the JA office and is accused, they get the same privacy rights as individuals at the moment. We don't necessarily know who did the hazing.
So to build on that, the privacy rights of individuals will absolutely always and continue to be guarded very heavily and are not put out there for public information. What this does is it allows to say that X organization was found to be in violation of X portion of the code, but it does not say specifically who was involved or what was involved. And they did have, under the code, they did have rights to be treated as an individual and have that information protected.
All right, Mitch. Sorry, blinking.
Jim.
Jim.
So, I don't quite agree with the way you do 16 or 17. All who are involved in the investigation will appear on the reporting process are allowed to maintain confidentiality, except for the way you find in the code. And what this is saying is the records of registered organizations may be shared in this process. The people, don't, unless it's part of the official records, then it's not just somebody commenting off the records. It's them asking for official records and reports, and this allows them to. They have access to the group to do it under these specific circumstances.
Right.
And that was the
deal. Thank you.
Evan?
I wanted to ask, I don't know if you have to go into hypotheticals or if it could be talked about more broadly. The sense that I get is that the amendment is proposed to allow for the kinds of hazing that have happened with Greek letter organizations. Mm-hmm. But that the language here is broad enough to include all organizations. My question is basically, do you know of situations, or can you imagine what kinds of situations you might see where you're dealing with non-Greek letter organizations and there's code violations?
Sure, financial misconduct by student organizations, falsifying travel receipts, reimbursement vouchers, things like that. Exclusion of membership based on, you know, things that are covered under the code. Let your imagination sort of run wild. There are those situations that have existed and then are protected. And one of the things I personally feel strongly, I think the sentiment of the committee was, is that the community has a right to know how university organizations are sort of stewarding the code, and are they living to that? Are they a good and just and upright sort of organization? You know, or are they doing some shady stuff and they're getting protected, but they're still able to recruit rapidly because they nobody knows about it. Except those involved.
Peter?
It's all about getting the information to the students so that they can make the educated choice whether or not to join X or Y organization.
Randy?
This is speaking the way the things that Alex brought up. I wonder if in the surveillance resolution there's any talk about who gets to see the film.
The surveillance resolution is enabled on the case itself.
It's not on the table, but I guess we could answer very shortly. I think there are already policies involving surveillance that's already in place in the university, so we'll be adhering to those codes. All right. Mitch? Jim? Sorry.
A lot of the system, you know, the Greeks already have reporting systems, but you can imagine that sports teams could be accused of hazing. Other organizations could have internal processes like that. And, you know, there was a sense that the hazing stuff, the website stuff, might indicate that, you know, all bad things that might happen at a university all happen in the Greek letter system when that isn't true, given a more holistic view.
I guess I'm a little bit unclear about what kinds of organization violations are prosecutable. I mean, the thing that comes to mind is when we're talking about registered student organizations, you know, the Cornell Piano Club, that kind of organization. And then varsity athletics is a very different kind of a thing. That is administered as part of student academic services. That's not a student organization. Now, club sports, again, is yet a different thing. So if we're talking about hazing in a club sports environment, versus hazing in a varsity environment. Are varsity sports going through the code process? Are we dealing with something where the Cornell football team could be on hazing?
As students, they're governed under the code.
As individuals, but I mean,
if the organization is doing something, and this is my understanding, and I think Mary got to maybe speak more clearly to that question. I think that the question that you raised, I do believe that they fall under that sort of governance.
But it's clear too that athletic organizations are run by facts.
Right.
So first blushing, depending on the type of issue that you're dealing with, you may be going through an HR process.
Yeah.
Through the code process.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So I guess the question would be a little bit of a
Could you hit on that? There are circumstances under which a group of football team members may independently
And their right to privacy is still protected under the code.
As individuals, always. And I never think.
What about, I know our guests are here, throwing a final thing. What about the right? Say we're talking about misconduct by officers of an organization. So we report that this organization engaged in a violation of the code. Are we still protecting the behavior of, say, the president or the treasurer or whatever of that organization? Or are they going to be publicly named?
Only if they're publicly charged. So if they're charged through the judicial system, they retain their personal rights.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
All right, we're going to table the discussion on Resolution 5 and welcome President David Scorton and Vice President Tommy Bruce to our meeting.
Or you could just continue the discussion of Resolution 5 and then we're saving time when you send it to me.
That'd be cool.
Gordon, you have the floor.
Thank you. I want to leave the vast majority of the time open for you, but I want to thank you, as I always do, because I mean it, for having me and for doing what you do, which is unbelievably important to me and more important than me to the institution. And I want to thank you for being willing to take on the task of looking at the output of the investigations related to the whole plaza incident, which I know that you're in the process of doing. And I look forward, whenever that time comes, to getting your feedback on that. So try to talk about whatever you like today.
Is there any topics that the assembly would like President Gordon to discuss?
I believe last meeting we came up with we'd like more information on the Hope Plaza incident, and it's not where it currently is in the process, but where you see it going from here.
Well, as you know, there were two resolutions passed by the Faculty Senate. One of them asked me to do an investigation, which I did, and you've gotten the output of that. You've met with the people who did it. And then the other one was to ask the Senate themselves to do an investigation. And I think in an ideal situation, and in the UA, I'm asking you to work on the output of the investigation, because one of the important findings was that there was a conflict between statements in administrative area, an administrative document, and the campus code. If you read the statement very closely, if you're a strict constructionist, there's no conflict between them, because the statement and the campus code have all kinds of qualifiers in it. But still, I think to the reasonable people would see that there's a conflict. I thought there was. And so ideally, I think you would also get the output of the Faculty Senate investigation, so you'd have a broader output. And I think after I first sent it to you, Joy, I think I sent you a follow-up note after I was at the Faculty Senate and said, maybe you should hold off. And I know that Dean Burns said, don't hold off. So it's great that you're doing it, and I'm going to take very seriously whatever you come up with. You will apparently or possibly come up with something before the faculty report is done. Faculty report may not be done this semester. And so it's going to be months more, if that's correct. And I guess, despite the fact that I think it would be more robust process if you had all the input, I do think it's a long time to wait to begin to work on reconciling an apparent conflict in documents. So I'm glad you are working on it. When I get your conclusion and your recommendation, then I have to think about what to do with them in face of the faculty review. And my fallback position, and I want to think about this, and I haven't decided, and it depends on what you suggest, what you recommend, but I'm thinking of going ahead and acting on what you recommend rather than waiting for the faculty output, although you understand that that could cause another round of coming back and talking about it if there's some discrepancy between what you and I decide to do and what the output of that investigation. So we'll just have to see. What you saw the conclusions that General Counsel Mingle had in that, I actually agree with. I don't think people's right to freedom of speech or academic freedom were encroached on, and you may or may not agree with me about that. And I'm a long time follower of and reader of AAUP documents, which is the definitional basis of academic freedom that most of us, at least in my generation, subscribe to. And based on my reading of the original documents that came out in the 1940s, as well as updates 20 to 25 years later, I don't think lines were crossed. But I do think that the conflict in the UUP document versus the campus code of conduct need to be resolved in some fashion, because this is a campus that has a very proud tradition of demonstrating. And One of the reasons that I don't think there's a chilling effect in general is all the protests I've had since I've been president in my office or in Day Hall, many, many, many of them. And you don't know what they would have been, I suppose, if there wasn't a permitting process. I don't think any of those went through that process, the ones that I'm aware of. I think Tommy and I have dealt together with something on the order of 10 of them since I've been president, maybe more, something like that. But we'll see. Some of the party hearing what you have to say about it. And about the faculty investigation, I have no idea. I know the process is going forward. I have no idea exactly when that will be over. Mm-hmm.
Greg?
Thank you both for being here. I chair the CJC, so we've got many members of the CJC here. And I think one of the questions that I sort of struggle with, and I know there's probably some of you agree with me, is to my understanding, the Faculty Senate investigation is more about the specific incident and what took place. And I guess my personal belief is that the CJC and the UA needs to sort of reconcile the question that's been raised about the code.
Definitely.
And that we're not necessarily investigating that specific incident, because I think there's plenty of folks that are doing that.
Yeah.
I think we're taking the code and the UUP process and trying to see, do those link up, do they need to link up, or what clarification needs to be brought in outside of that incident, but using that incident as the catalyst to start that discussion. Because I personally don't want to be involved in the specific investigation of the incident, because I think there's plenty of folks that have already done that or are going to do that.
Since you're in a way, the ultimate, most fulsome shared governance group, because every portion of campus is represented here in a robust way, you should do whatever you think is right. You shouldn't be limited to what I wrote to Joy. You should do whatever you think is right. However, in a statutory sense, you are the group that should recommend changes in the code, and or, even though this is not a group that's specifically charged with every little administrative area, I'm asking you to comment on that as well. And then what has to happen then is the general counsel needs to be consulted again. And because I believe that this is one of those cases where this sort of line that we're always concerned about between governance and management should be blurred. I think that I want to come back and, with your permission, have a conversation with you about whatever you send me, listen to the nuances of it as well. And then I want to also share it with the Board of Trustees, because it has to do with the environment for the campus. I think it's important. But I understand what you're saying about not wanting to go back again and look at the details of what happened. You know, either way you do it is fine with me, because that's the point of shared governance. You should do what you think is right. But there will be some rendering of opinion by a group selected by the Faculty Senate, and we'll see what that says. I guess I should say one more thing, and I always try to be totally open with you guys and not pull any punches. I don't find any evidence that any employee of the university in any capacity did anything wrong on that day that would require some sort of discipline or problem, something like that. That's just how I feel. I look at a lot of the evidence. I look at everything that was gathered, talk to a lot of people myself. And we'll see what other people have to say about it. But it was an emotionally charged day with very high feelings that happened anyway during demonstrations, especially on a topic that's as divisive and has been going on as long all over the world as that has. And I think that, I guess I'll just say this, that the staff members who were there that day, the senior police department and the event managers, did the best they could to keep the situation that was already emotionally charged from becoming more problematic. That's my conclusion. And I doubt if I'll be swayed in that opinion, but we'll wait to see what anything else shows up. Thanks for listening. You're in.
I'm wondering if there's anybody, so I don't know how much it comes to stuff that I've circulated
I read all of them. Because when you send some, I'm afraid not to read it. Because I'll come from you and you'll say, did you read email of such and such a date, page 11? So I did read it.
So I try to put out feelers for the people that were involved in the demonstration and county demonstration to see if anybody would take some responsibility to talk to the other side, to understand that the other side has some right to speak, to meddle with side.
Right, absolutely.
And my interpretation of what went around, I never actually got even made on something like that. So, which was disappointing to me. And because there's different ways to solve the problem, legally or through individuals involved or through administration. So I'm wondering if there's anybody at the higher administration level that has the time to and the interest to recognize when these kind of problems might happen and do something proactively without it being written into the code.
Well, you know, this is such an important insightful question. Honestly, this cuts to the whole core of the matter. In an ideal world, and I, you know, with all apologies to Chief Zoner, in an ideal world, you wouldn't need a CU police department for internal things on campus. In an ideal world, you wouldn't need event managers, right? Even the term event manager, unless you're talking about, you know, somebody managing a celebratory event or a board dinner, you wouldn't need those kind of things. So why do we have those? Why do we have the police department? Why do we have event managers? Besides logistical reasons, like making sure people can get around campus, it's because you don't know whether it's going to be possible in a heated time for people to find a way to come together. I think the more the campus comes to depend on external forces to get people to talk to each other, the more I'm going to feel depressed about the campus. And the more we can move in the direction that you're suggesting, the better we're all going to feel about the campus. And so the most effective things that have happened, I think, Randy, have nothing to do with the administration. It has to do with how different organizations come together. So on this particular issue, the Hillel and the various Muslim student organizations working together, I think does more, at least potentially, for understanding among those groups than any number of speeches by the president. And I know it's hard to imagine that presidential speeches don't solve every problem, but I mean, grassroots stuff is the answer. But in this circumstance, this particular circumstance, just as an exemplar, Randy, of another kind of circumstance that might occur on some other issue, this is a situation that anyway is unbelievably divisive and emotional off the campus. And then we're seeing a representation of it on the campus. So it's not surprising, disappointing, like you say, but not surprising that people didn't want to step across an emotional line to say, well, let's try to figure out how to understand each other a little bit and come to some conclusion. Think about all the forces that have been brought back in the Middle East to try to find some way to do that. How many U.S. presidents and prime ministers of the Palestinian territories and of Israel tried that? So I think we just have to get through whatever advice you guys have in terms of the statutory environment here, but never forget that the whole point of shared governance is to have the power for that reconciliation in the hands of the people on the campus. So I'm skeptical that administrative work can be done. I mean, we're graced to have a super great police chief here who cares more about this stuff than many people in law enforcement do. But even then, police force is going to have a very limited ability to deal with these kind of high emotions, except, heaven forbid, you know, if some real violence breaks out, you just stop it. But that didn't happen in this case. And I think part of the reason it didn't happen in this case is because there was some gentle intervention. And part of the reason is that this is a gentle campus. It's a gentle campus. It's a campus where people have really strong feelings and like to express them, and thank goodness they do. But it's basically a very gentle, forgiving, collegial environment. That's why people like it here, you know? So it's tough. It really is tough. I'm not surprised, but I'm disappointed like you are. And thanks for using different colors in those emails, too. That really helps us. No, I do appreciate the fact that you let me watch from the chief seat as you were doing it.
Jim?
Why
Alice? Okay. Mitch?
So unless someone else has something on following this topic, I'm wondering, I know that IMT report came out. I lost track of time anymore.
Several weeks ago.
On May 26th.
Yep.
But what's
happening May
26th?
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I forgot about that. Yeah. I check on the calendar.
But I'm curious, I know that the IMT report came out a substantially long time, and I don't know the reasons for that, after the discussion on them at the end of last semester. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious to know, has there been, from your perspective or the students or vice president of the office, has there been further discussion on those?
Yep.
And what's the status of
those? Yep. Part of the reason that there was a gap between when you all stopped meeting about those and when they came out is that I thought it was important not to release that during the break, during the winter break. I suppose we could have, right, Tommy, and people would see them whenever they see them, like an online world, but still, a deference to the sun and so on, I thought it was good to release it then. But please make no mistake, what the groups that worked on that are working toward is nothing less than trying to work in a campus climate. I mean, this is like serious long-term stuff. And so it is frustrating that everything takes so long, but the groups that are leading it, Dr. Murphy and Mary Opperman and others, are taking a three-dimensional, in-depth look at how this is going to change. Everything from the way communications is used on point in time to the role of different groups on campus. And one of the big issues is the level of setting policy and aspirations on the one hand. I know you know all about this thing. And then how do you operationalize it in a way that's not too bureaucratic, but has some process to it. And so I got another update from Dr. Murphy on this just earlier this week, which I guess must have been yesterday, because it's just Tuesday. Is that right? Yeah, sorry, yesterday. Each day. I expect to get more stuff out to the campus in the few weeks between now and when commencement occurs. There's been no letdown on the energy with which people are working on it, but they're trying to make the output as specific and crisp as possible so people understand really, really what's going to happen. And the reaction, enforcement, and education, planks of this are pretty well developed. It's a question of how to operationalize things that affect the campus climate more broadly, in addition to education, that everybody's trying to figure out the best way to do it, and who will be held accountable, and how will we follow up and check it. And so I know it's taken a long time. Please be patient. It didn't fall into some, administrative black hole. People are working on it in a serious way. One issue that I always tell you all, to remind you, not that you need to be reminded by me, and I'm not using it as an excuse, but just a reality reminder, is that we're operating with many fewer staff now than we used to have. And not going to change, for the foreseeable future. So people are doing multiple things, but this is very, very high on the list. And I suppose, I'm always at your service if you want to try to figure out some other time for me to come personally, or if I can't get there exactly at the right time, have someone else come in my stead. But we'll certainly, Tommy and I will certainly have something out before the end of the semester, and that's for sure.
Well, we did issue the statement on February 28th.
Yeah, but what Mitch is asking was...
Just so you remember that.
Yes.
Okay. But the follow up.
No, I understand.
Yeah. And so there's gonna be multiple milestones of reporting.
Was there any community feedback on the report that went out?
All kinds of feedback. I don't think since that date there's been any forums but there's been a lot of feedback, individual feedback.
Right.
Would you be able, Tommy, to let them know a little bit more by checking with Susan Murphy about giving some, I'm assuming you'd like to know something about the scope, how much feedback, and sort of what it looked like. I don't think she'll be able to give you a report, a formal report real soon. So would you be able to do that?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you. Good question.
Evan?
So this isn't really a question, more of a comment, I guess. So I'm working this semester as an instructor at the Cornell Prison Education Program.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say that I really appreciated your op-ed on Forbes, that comment came out earlier this week. I think that was yesterday. I think that Cornell, as land-grant university for the world, is certainly a land-grant university in New York, has this responsibility really to engage the community. I think it's an important educational opportunity for our graduate and undergraduate students, and I think it's also we have a moral responsibility to give back to try and make the world a better place, frankly. I think the Cornell Prison Education Program is a real example of that. Someone who's now 2 months into seeing firsthand just how big a difference this program makes in the lives of the folks up at Auburn Correctional is revelatory to me, and I think exceedingly important. And beyond the sort of, as your op-ed so clearly pointed out, beyond the kind of humanitarian mission, the let's make the world a better place kind of thing that I'm saying, there's also hard-nosed economic things here too. Education while in prison reduces recidivism. Reducing recidivism lowers costs for prisons, reduces the burden on taxpayers, gets more people out into the workforce, reduces hopefully the per capita imprisonment in this country, which again, the op-ed pointed out, is so much higher than several of the countries that your information. So I wanted to basically just to thank you for getting that out there, and likewise for Cornell's support.
So I so appreciate that. If you have a chance and you're so inclined, write a note to Glenn Altshuler, it was his idea. And just to give credit where credit's due, to one of Tommy's senior colleagues, Claudia Wheatley, did a lot of the research on that, research outside of the Auburn area in the immediate, like 1 or 2 hour circumference around Ithaca. So if you have a chance, it's always nice when people can have it, can be recognized. I also want to recognize that when I first met Tommy over 7 years ago, he said that an Ivy League school like Cornell was a platform, and that if you wanted to, you could try to comment on things that were broader than the campus, even the campus issues. And so through Tommy's encouragement, we've been trying to do a lot of this. We had a piece out today on CNN.com because kids all over the country are getting their acceptance letters, to school and trying to decide where to go. So I have a little piece on college value, which you want to look at, and they need to tell me if you thank me for that one or not. And then we had, we have stuff that we're doing in the Forbes, Huffington Post, now CNN, and once in a while some other venues. And it's it's very interesting. The other interesting thing, I know you guys know this from your generation, and even younger, you're not that young anymore, actually. you're really not. I mean, compared to the 40,000 applicants for the freshman class for this fall, you're like
ancient.
The word fossil came to mind. But what's interesting is the difference. Like, if you publish an op-ed in a printed newspaper, then a couple days later, you send a letter to the editor. You do this, and about 8 nanoseconds later, there's this many people in the comments section telling you all the things you did wrong, your analysis was faulty, whatever it is. That's just fascinating. I remember one piece that we had in Huffington Post on immigration reform, which was a big priority for me. Within a couple of days, there were 200 or something comments, mostly negative, about the whole thing, about the whole op-ed.
I know that I emailed you and Vice President Johnson on the immigration things, and you had mentioned the possible advocacy work on it.
Yeah.
Is there any update on that?
Yeah, here's what we're doing. So you all know that the immigration reform is just a massive issue for the whole country, and a bunch of us have been working on this for years and years and years to absolutely no avail. No of what you're talking about, Dream Act or more people allowed to get green cards or whatever it is. And we've given Tommy C. Johnson and I worked up the extended testimony, all kinds of stuff. No effect whatsoever. But after this last election, all of a sudden everybody's interested in immigration reform. It's understandable. And so myself and two presidents of other schools sent a letter to 1,200 presidents and chancellors around the country to urge local advocacy. These other presidents are leaders, much more experienced than I am. One is Eduardo Padron, who is the president of the biggest college in the United States, Miami-Dade Community College, 170,000 students on multiple campuses in Dade County. It's unbelievable. And the other one is Michael Crow, who ironically I know from Iowa days. He was at Iowa State when I was at Iowa. He was at Columbia for some years and then Arizona State.
Did he say it because of the Iowa State?
No, absolutely not. No. The only school that I have any grudges about at all in any way is Kentucky for what happened to us in the Sweet 16. if you have time at the end, I can tell you a really funny vignette about that, but we don't have to do that. But it's pretty funny if you want to hear it. So Crow is the president of Arizona State University, which is also a mega university. And so we're asking on April 19th that schools have events to, you know, debate, have teach-ins, old-fashioned stuff from my day about immigration reform. And we're going to do stuff here in the afternoon of April 19th, and you'll be hearing more about it. Advocacy coming from real people like you, like I told you before about student aid and research, is much more effective than coming from me. Much more effective. When I walk in congressional offices, people's eyes glaze over. They just do. Sort of like when I came into the U.S. Same basic phenomenon. And so, if you and other people, the GPSA or the UA in general, are interested in this and you speak up, it'll have an effect, I think. And right now, the White House, both sides of the aisle, and both houses of Congress want to do something about this.
And the National Association of Graduate Professional Students, which GPSA belongs to, are very interested in this.
Yeah.
They're graduate professional students, chief lawyers, really, in D.C., and they're really pursuing immigration reform.
Cool.
I'll talk to you more about this.
That'd be great.
Greg?
Quick question, and maybe I just haven't done enough investigation. Is there a centralized place where all your various articles and contributions, sort of written pieces, are centrally located? I just was curious.
It has to go to the home page for the leadership that's been left behind the president's web page and all the statements.
Features and essays. Yeah. Okay. You got to get some caffeine going before you start reading that stuff. So. So, you want to hear about the Kentucky thing real quick before I go?
Yes.
All right. You want to hear or you don't want to hear?
Oh, yeah, I
want to hear. So, we won the first two rounds of March Madness, and nobody expected a bunch of nerds, they make fun of us nerds. And so, I get a call. Tommy had introduced me to the reporters at Bloomberg, And I got a call from one of them, we were just this week, actually, and said, is there any, the president of the University of Kentucky? And I do know, we served on a national organization together, Lee Todd, for years. And I said, yeah, I do. And I said, is there any chance you're going to communicate with them? They came, and I said, 100% chance. And she said, could we publish your email to them? And I checked with Tommy, and he said, as long as you're not stupid. That's actually what he said. And so we wrote some emails that were, special for the public email. And I wrote to him, and I said, something like, President Todd, it's wonderful to meet you on the field of battle, and we have enormous respect for your school, and it's terrible how you make fun of the, graduation rates and all this. And he wrote back and he said, yeah, we feel the same way about you. It's terrible that they consider you a bunch of non-entities in terms of sports. We, you're actually very talented athletes, that kind of stuff. And then we talked on the phone, and I said, can you imagine how great it would be if we beat you? I mean, how humiliating it would be for you. And then he said, well, as our, I think it was a forward, I can't remember, I think it was a forward, said, if I happen to talk to somebody from Cornell, you should mention that there's a lot of really, you know, smart people there and stuff, but this is not a spelling bee, it's a basketball game. So the game occurred, and, you know, there was a slight imbalance. And it ended really late at night, if you happen to remember, very late at night. And so I got a hold of him, and I said, what do you know? And he said, well, I will say one thing, this is exactly what he said. You had more fans, there was more red there than whatever they were called, or blue like that. And he said, that's really something for us at a Kentucky game. So that's the true story. I guess it wasn't that interesting, but at the time it was pretty, interesting. And then Harvard did one, you know, Harvard got one. One game.
Yeah. But the game was in Syracuse, yeah. Is that right? Am I remembering that right?
One of the games was in Syracuse.
Yeah,
That third game was in Syracuse, yeah. Yeah, so you're right. If it was in Kentucky, it would have been different. It was a little closer to
life. We were flooded, though.
Anyway, thank you all. And I hope you celebrate the holidays that are happening right around now. I hope it's a good holiday for you and your families. And I appreciate all the stuff you guys are doing. And then you'll be in touch, right, when you finish your deliberation. So thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for being here. We're going to continue the discussion for Resolution 5. Is there any further points on the floor? Yes, Mitch.
It's some kind of a weird thing. I forgot about it.
I'm kind of enjoying the seat on my shoulder. Do you want me to put it down? Oh, I'm kidding. Just a little question.
Whoa.
Not the curtain. Not the curtain. If I hunched down, I could still see
it. I'm not fortunate. I'll just show enough of that.
One thing I wanted to mention on Resolution 5, it kind of picks up on what's been said before. I think it makes sense. I don't have to talk to you about it, but I just wonder if there are plenty of especially student organizations that aren't registered, that are either departmental organizations, and I'm not sure under what guidelines they fall, if there is, I mean, you know, there's plenty of, you know, I'm only thinking of grad professional students, but there's plenty of organizations that exist that are like, you know, the fictional example, but like the City Regional Planning Club, where they just get the money here and there from their team or their department chair and do things and you know, this wouldn't, I mean, maybe this would cover them, I don't know. But I think that if you're looking, if the desired result is to have the university community be provided with more information on misconduct, that may not be as clear line there between what the university registered organization is and what's not, and in terms of the misconduct that might be. It's just a comment.
Yeah, no, if I can, and I don't know the technicality of things, but like trying to think back to my essay days, I would encourage you to tell those graduate student organizations to be formally recognized by the university and to get registered.
I would like that too.
Yeah,
there's a lot of it.
Yeah, because deans and other departments are funding little offshoots. We want to make sure that they get recognized by the university. You know, four of us got together and called ourselves a club. And we did something, it would probably be as individuals because that organization is not recognized by the university. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but I really don't know if there's much that can be done by people just randomly getting together and not acting as an organization. It really becomes a group of individuals who are involved in something. Right. My
understanding of how it is. So this is for registered organizations, and to be a legitimate organization on the campus and do all the benefits that come therein, I would say that they you can for registration.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a totally separate issue.
Yeah.
That, yes, I didn't realize the scope of the lack of registration that happened. But, I mean, for graduate students, you know, Willard's great. Might be, I mean, this is another, I'll talk about this later. The other aspect, and it may, you may have discussed this before, and I'm sorry if I'm just forgetting it, but does this apply to you? We're saying that UBSA, I'm a very malicious person, I'm president, and I steal money or something from the coffers of UBSA, and I'm the only one that did anything like that. Has UBSA, I guess, has done something wrong, but it's been by my actions. Does that not fall under the, so to speak,
individual actions? Your student rights will be protected as a student through the JA system, but if you're formally charged, you would fall under that. But you're not acting on, if you acted on behalf of the organization for something, that might be the only case where you would be, the paraorganization organization would be at least suspect whether or not
Yeah, so if you funneled money for the benefit of the assembly rather than yourself, that's when the GPSA would then be brought into it, potentially. But really, how the judicial administrator's office and the charges are brought will define how the case is handled.
Another
is 10. Yeah, it's
10.
Alex?
For the record, I have not.
the
danger of using yourself as an example.
So I just kind of wanted to go back to the question I had earlier about what exactly was changing. So I pulled up the hazing website, and it says, fraternity sororities and other groups have their stuff listed here, and then there's this page also lists violations by athletic teams and other student organizations. Is the other student organizations just not true? Like, is this actually protected, and this website's been claiming that we would report them the whole time? Or, like, is this change necessary? It seems like those two statements are inconsistent, and I'm just trying to clear up if they are in fact inconsistent.
I think if they have an opportunity to post them, they will. The website is just a forum by which, whatever feeder information gets to them, they have the authority to post. But the code, my understanding from the conversations with Meredith Grant, is that because the code is not explicitly inclusive of student organizations in some of their outlines, it has to be, in her mind and the office's mind, that it then has to be first interpreted that they have that right, as opposed to they don't have that right. So by the explicit mentioning of them, that clarifies. But again, it's a place of clarification where without that presence, you could argue either way that they would protect you or not protect you, so this is presented.
Jim?
Yes, we talked about the merits of why this would be a good change, but fundamentally it's a clarification so that the people who get these requests can in fact act on them in a consistent way with how the university does it for part of its group. It brings things into compliance. I'm not sure that it's perfect, but we've edited it very hard. It does no damage. It does make some improvements. It does clarify the code. And respectfully, I call the question.
All right. Thank you. Motion to vote? Oh.
No.
Nope. All right. All in favor of Resolution 5?
I think we're voting on the motion to call the
question. Yes.
Is there any opposition?
Is there any opposition to call into question? Nope. I guess resolution 5 is.
Basically, I'm trying to end the discussion and get to the vote.
All right, thank you.
One more discussion, they should vote me down. And
I thought I got this last time, but nope. Yeah.
Parliamentary procedure, you asked for other objections to calling the question.
Right.
And there were none. So now we're
actually. Now motion to vote.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if there's anything inconsistent with what I just said, I'm sure I didn't.
Third time's the charm. I'll get it next time. All right. Motion vote.
We already did that.
Oh, okay. Now voting on resolution 5. All in favor? All. 11. All that oppose. All that abstain. Resolution 5 has been passed, 11-0-0. Now the floor is open for discussion. Any discussion topics? None. I motion to adjourn the meeting.
Second.
The meeting is adjourned at 5:47 p.m. Tuesday, March 26th.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.